99-82, Cincinnati Board of Education versus Board of Revision of Hamilton County et al. Mr. DeMuzio.
Thank you. My name is Dave DeMuzio, and I'm the attorney for the school board. This case involves a situation in which the auditor's records were incorrect concerning the ownership of a particular parcel. The school board filed its complaint based upon those incorrect records and without knowledge that they were incorrect. The true owner had notice of the error in the records, in fact, received the 1996 tax bill and did nothing about it. And that's in the transcript at page 12. The BTA later ruled that the Supreme Court complaint should be dismissed because it listed the incorrect owner. It sounds incredible, but that's in fact what's happened. Before we go any further, I would like to direct the court to look at the second last page of our brief, if you have it there. We attach copies of two of the statutes that govern the Board of Revision activities. The second last page, you'll see at the bottom, it says page 741 of the statute book. That is statute 571511. It talks about the kinds of records that the County Board of Revision is to look at. And you'll see there that in the first sentence of that statute, it says that the county board shall hear complaints relating to the valuation or assessment of real property as the same appears upon the tax duplicate of the then current year. Clearly, legislature is indicating a tax record should be the ones that they look at. The very last page, which is the next page of the submission with our brief, is a copy of 5715.12 of the revised code. And about four or five lines down, you'll see the words, by the description thereof as carried on the tax list of the current year and shall state the name in which it is listed. And there it's talking about the duty to give notice before an increase. So clearly, which by the way we were trying to do here, we were moving to increase the value. So clearly, the legislature intended that whatever records were utilized ought to be the tax records. The facts of the case.
Let me ask you a question.
Sure.
Having read the record and anything on this, there was one item that kept appearing, and I read the supplements, I've read all the briefs and everything. I have not gone downstairs and gotten the full record. There was talk about an order revision decision that was issued on August 18th of 1987, and I didn't see a copy of that.
Of 1997?
97, excuse me. Was that actually sent out, or was there?
Yes, it was actually sent out, and in fact,
is it in the record somewhere?
I right now couldn't cite you to it, but yes, it should be. It was certainly
okay.
Part of the.
I didn't see it in the supplements. Or
the eventual decision that formed this appeal, Supreme Court, that decision had the same case number, the same BOR case number. And was considered by the Hamilton County BOR to be a reopening of the same case. So in that August 1990, was actually an August 1997 decision, I'm sorry. That decision was in fact mailed and no appeal was taken. And in fact, it's referred to in the BTA, I think it's referred to in the BTA decision.
Now, Ken, after that decision was sent out, 30 days has passed.
Yes. Yes, no appeal was taken. We actually won that. The school board won the first round.
Right.
No appeal is taken. We assume the case is over. And again, our position is that it appears that the true owner, was never notified.
Okay.
And go ahead.
You mentioned that the true owner knew about it.
Yes.
I read the page 12. What exactly?
On page 12 of the transcript, put hands on it here briefly.
Was a statement that involved Miss Marlene McDaniel, who was an employee, and I'm asking her what
McDaniel was an employee
of the auditor's office,
okay.
Right? And you'll see at the top, I'm asking her, for Ms. McDaniel, the 1998 tax year, shows a mailing to Candlewood. Am I correct? The reading for 1997 shows a reading to Anthony Sansalone. That's correct. That means for tax years 96 and 97, they would have gone to Mr. Sansalone and not Candlewood. That's correct. Then she changes it. She says, no, the tax bill would have been going to Candlewood. Oh, it was going right. So what she's saying is, and this is quite common in the auditor's office, that the tax bills were going to Candlewood. In fact, we know that because we know in 97 what triggered everybody finding out about this mistake is that Candlewood got its 1997 tax bill, and which still showed Anthony Sansalone as the owner.
Isn't that a little bit removed from, I found out from somebody or I got the bill, but in reading this, I didn't get, you know, she said, Ms. McDaniel said that we don't have any evidence that from anybody from Candlewood came in and said that they got the bill.
No, there was nothing on that record, and they did get a chance to test.
Auditors, is there anything in the auditor's documents that would indicate that the bill was mailed to Candlewood?
The 1996 bill?
Yeah.
Not to my knowledge, but again, as far as I'm concerned, when an auditor's representative speaks about what's on the auditor's records and they say it was mailed to Candlewood, but you're correct. One of the problems, I don't want to take a lot of time now on it, but one of the problems is we were never given a hearing at the BTA to put any evidence on. They made their decision based solely upon the BOR record. We had filed a motion to dismiss the underlying complaint in this appeal, the underlying countercomplaint, and to reinstate the original decision. And we made very clear to the BTA it was a very narrow motion. And in their reply, they said, we think this is these are all the issues before the board. We replied and said, no, if you don't agree with us on this narrow jurisdictional issue, we expect a hearing to discuss whether we were negligent or not. We never got that hearing. So
the jurisdictional issue is the real
yes.
issue here.
Yes.
And could this set a bad precedent that, let's say Candlewood didn't have this hearing?
Yes.
You would think that somebody after we had a situation where somebody hadn't received the bill for a year or two, that they would inquire.
Yes.
But, we've gone, of course, gone fairly far on complaints, what's in them, but when you don't have the actual name of the property.
Yes, I would agree. And the statutes do provide relief for the taxpayer. It's called 2723.01. That's what should have happened. If the court ends up holding what's happened so far, what that means is school districts or anybody that relies upon incorrect auditor's records is really precluded from getting their day in court, and that's not fair. The best thing would have been for them to file suit under 2723.01, claim they'd not received due process. They would have gotten a due process hearing. We would have gotten our due process hearing. The way it's worked is they've tried to do an end run around that. They don't want to do that because they know, they've admitted already that the sale was an arm's length sale. So they're going to lose the merit hearing. And so their only hope is to get it thrown out on this technicality. I wanted to mention that we have three problems, and they're fairly distinct. And we think all three are valid, and all three, each one by itself, would merit a reversal. The statutes prescribe, as I mentioned, the proper method of challenging this sort of a mistake, and it requires going to common police court under 2723.01. I cited the Supreme Court case of
what's the time of 2723? I don't know.
They have, I quoted in the record, in the brief, they have a year from the time that the illegal tax is collected, I think is the way the statute reads. And of course, that hasn't run yet. So they still, if this board were to remand it, or to reverse it, they do have the power, they do still have an opportunity to go to common police court. It says, no recovery shall be had unless the action is brought within 1 year after the taxes or assessments are collected. And there's been no tax collected. As soon as they learned about the tax, they protested and asked that it be reopened. I did cite the Supreme Court case of Caron v. Wisner. In that case, the court specifically said that 2723.01 provided adequate remedy if the auditor failed to comply with statutory requirements. One of the assertions here is that the auditor did not properly notify the true owner. So we feel that clearly this applies. That's our strongest argument. What we're saying is the statutes provide on how to on what to do in these situations. Had they followed it, both parties would have gotten justice. They chose not to do that. The second problem involves the fact that the BTA ruled upon matters outside its jurisdiction. And there we cite the Cook v. Kenny case, which says that the BTA is strictly limited to power set forth by the statute. Nowhere that I could find in the statute relating to the BTA is the BTA given power to review cases that have already been decided but not appealed. The original 1997 decision was never appealed, yet the BTA set the complaint aside anyway.
So your contention is that this August 18, 1997 was
the final order. Yes.
You had to appeal within
30 days
of that.
Yeah, and if you didn't, and there was some blemish on that, then it could have gone to the Common Pleas Court. There's also a second aspect that we note in the brief to this exceeding their powers. The BTA ruled that we should have consulted the recorder's records, the county recorder's records. And again, we feel that's contrary to the legislative statutes, which say that tax records govern. And we think that they were outside their powers to rule that. The third problem is that the BTA decision was not supported by any probative evidence. They make the actual quote here on page 6 of their decision that, quote, the auditor's records, if appropriately researched, would have revealed Candlewood Limited as the owner. There is absolutely no such evidence in the record anywhere. It's undisputed at the BOR hearing that the auditor's records were incorrect and were not corrected until the spring of 1998, a year after we filed. And again, you should see
page...
Yes, that's how this mistake happened. The conveyance fee was filed. There were a series of transactions, three or four, that occurred, and the final one said that Mr. Sansalone was now the owner. And as I'm sure the court's aware, yes, it was a mistake, but it didn't show up as a mortgage. It showed up as an actual conveyance. And the law requires, and the court's been pretty strict about this, that you have to use the current owner. So we had to use Mr. Sansalone. Now, there's been allegations that somehow, you know, when we saw the $55,000 transfer, we should have known that should have triggered something. Our position is, and I've seen this plenty of times myself, it's quite common for there to be non-arm's length transactions between related parties where the values don't match what the true market value is. And as I mentioned in my reply brief, I actually quote from the conveyance fee statement in which Candlewood received its title before it was transferred out again. And in there, they didn't even pay a transfer tax because they claimed that they were only going to hold it a short time, and sure enough, it got sold again. There was also a statement made by the appellees that somehow we didn't research it properly. Again, we cite in the brief the fact that the sale price we used appeared on the third or fourth prior conveyance fee statement. So we knew about the prior conveyances. We did everything that we thought needed to be done. I wanted to point out that on page 17 of Candlewood's brief, they make a big error, and this was pointed out in my reply brief. They try to list what they think is the evidence supporting the BTA decision, and I think it was number 4 on page 17. They say, oh, gee, the deed, the mortgage records were all there. Well, they were there, but they were there because Mr. Kreider put them there in 1998. They were not there in 1997, and again, there was simply no basis for the BTA's statement that had we researched it properly, we would have found it out. In conclusion, and this is important for the court to understand, the school board did everything right. They did everything correctly in accordance with the law. They utilized the proper records. They listed the current owner listed on those records, and they showed up and litigated at the hearing. The taxpayer and the auditor made all the mistakes. The auditor had the incorrect ownership information. The true owner had knowledge of the auditor's mistake in 1990 on the 1996 tax bill and did nothing about it. Due to its negligence and its inaction, the mistake is not corrected, and the school board was incorrectly listed the owner. If this is upheld, it would have the effect of denying the school board its due process. We get no merit hearing because the auditor and the taxpayer made mistakes. And finally, you'll hear due process arguments from the other side. They did get a merit hearing. It's in the transcript in April of 1998. Thank you.
May it please the court. My name is Kenneth P. Kreider of Key Music in Clee Camp, Cincinnati, Ohio, and I'm here on behalf of the Appellee Candlewood Limited. And with me on the brief was Dwight Packard, who's with me today. The owner of the property, Candlewood, respectfully requests that the decision of the BTA be affirmed for three major reasons. The school board's original complaint failed to properly identify the owner, and so it was therefore defective at the outset. Depriving the BOR of jurisdiction from the outset was void ab initio. Number two, the BOR's August 18, 1997 decision, which the school board's attempting to reinstate, is void because the BOR failed to provide Candlewood with the mandatory notices required by the statutes, principally sections RC 5715-12, 5715-19, and 5715-20. Third, if the BOR's decision is reinstated, then Candlewood will have been denied its procedural due process pursuant to the Ohio Constitution and the U.S. Constitution. Mr. DiMuzio, at his conclusion, on behalf of the school board, said that they would be denied their due process and that we had had a merits hearing. But of course, the original merits hearing, my client was not notified of and was not given any opportunity to respond to those arguments.
I have a question.
Yes, sir.
Where does the Board of Revision get authority to allow you to file a counter-complaint, after they've previously decided the case?
Your Honor, I think the relevant principles to apply, because the Board of Revision is a statutory creation, and the procedures are largely statutory, and where the statutes are silent, I think we have to analogize to the civil rules and judicial decisions, since, of course, the Board of Revision is a quasi-judicial body the Supreme Court has held. It is in the nature of a Rule 60B reconsideration of prior activity by that board when they realized that they had a problem on their hands, a jurisdictional problem. I'd also point out several Supreme Court cases that aren't cited in my brief, but I have some citations for you today, that a court may act sua sponte to revisit subject matter jurisdiction issues. They may be raised at any time if they find a defect in their subject matter jurisdiction.
Subject matter jurisdiction.
Yes. Well, again, I think it's by analogy, since we don't have civil rules specifically applicable to the Board of Revision. We have to fill the gaps with other decisions and by analogy to the civil rules of procedure. The court did have a question of Mr. DiMuzio asking for evidence in the record, if we had it, of the notice of the August 1897 decision. If Your Honor would see page 23 of Appley Supplement, there is a notice of result that we attached in our supplement, and you'll see the date on that. The notice of result was finally mailed by the Hamilton County Board of Revision on February 25, 1998. Again, it was mailed, though, to the incorrect owner, Anthony Sansaloni, trustee at Marshall Avenue, which isn't even the taxpayer's address. The record is hazy or silent, but it was around that time that, due to the receipt of a tax bill with an increase, that it finally reached the attention of the client. Mr. DiMuzio makes a couple of assertions, which I think are really inferences from the record, about negligence on the part of the taxpayer, not noticing this, sitting on his hands. That's mentioned in the brief a few times. Inaction, sort of a laches argument that that the client, Candlewood Limited, and its principal, Bruce Anderson, had the tax bills for years and did nothing about it. My client operates many apartment projects and may not even and I think the inference could go the other way, may not even see the bill itself, but simply sign checks. And if the amounts are correct, I think the inference is that that there was nothing to be concerned about. The timing, I think, of the when the increased bill would have come out is indicative. The inference could be drawn that he acted as soon as it came to his attention.
We don't know who the bill was actually sent to.
I believe that the record would show, based on Ms. McDaniel's comments and copies of the bills that may have been part of the record, that the bills did go to Candlewood at its, or they went to its post office address, post office box address, but the name on the bill was Sansaloni Trustee. I am skipping around a little bit, but just to reach the points that Mr. DiMuzio made, and then I'll go back to my presentation. Another one was concerning the BTA's evidence, or that they did not have evidence in the record to support their affirmance, I guess, of the dismissal below. Couple of things. The public records, the deeds and mortgages mentioned that were delivered as evidence in the hearing were, in fact, public records available for inspection in the recorder's office. And in addition to that, I think the BTA is based its factual findings on a previous conveyance fee statement, which was actually the date of the deed. Number one, that was the conveyance fee statement identifying Candlewood as the fee symbol owner, and a BOR factual finding, which was in evidence that the BTA was able to review and consider, that the $55,000 valuation on the conveyance fee statement that the appellant wants to rely on should have been a red flag. That was stated by one of the board members. Two reasons, Your Honor. One, it is premature to use that statute since the illegal assessment has not yet been collected. Secondly, when the board, the statute states that it is to remedy the collection of illegal levies or assessments when the taxing authorities refuse or disagree with your characterization of those as improper. It is an injunctive remedy, a statutory injunctive remedy. It's not an exclusive remedy, though, Your Honor. Go ahead.
Right. You have paid this bill.
Bills have been paid. Yes.
Your position is you can't join anything that there's nothing to enjoin.
I believe there's not yet been an illegal levy or assessment. We're still at the stage of valuation determination. And that's a third reason, Your Honor, why we didn't turn to an injunctive remedy in this case, is that the Board of Revision, again, acting perhaps it was a sua sponte reconsideration and an attempt to comply with the statutes that govern the Board itself, realizing that the true owner had not been identified in the school board's complaint. Once the tax records were corrected by Ms. McDaniel, I believe, the Board of Revision then nonetheless reopened the proceeding, sent the notice, and the notice, of course, states right on its face, and I believe that notice is also in our supplement, that you, property owner, have 30 days to respond to this complaint. So we were then, at that stage, we were statutorily required to either respond with a countercomplaint or live with the defective decision. So we proceeded along the procedures that are required by statute, promptly filing a countercomplaint, raising on the face of the countercomplaint the jurisdictional defect.
Would you say that you're saying that the board, when they sent you that notice, it was too late?
The issue of whether it was too late for them to reopen their proceedings, that was an issue that the appellant could have raised at the same time or in response to our motion to dismiss. And our motion to dismiss, I think the records in the record of the verbal testimony in the transcript and then in the follow-up briefs, we were well aware of the Stangem decision and the Cleveland Illuminating decision and all of the other decisions that say that a complaint embodies the statutory framework, DT Form 1. The court has approved that, and that embodies procedural due process. So that was the focus of the appellee, the property owner, is that this process was invalidly begun, this revaluation process, and we were in the valuation stage of this. We weren't yet at another stage, so that the argument could have been raised by the appellant in response to our motion to dismiss. The requirement of due process and the decisions of the courts, especially in the Cleveland Illuminating case, which is cited in our brief, to be valid, a complaint must contain all information to satisfy core procedural efficiency. I think the meaning of that is that for due process to be served and for parties to have the fair and adequate opportunity for hearing and to respond to allegations such as these for value increases, the complaint must at a minimum meet these requirements that the courts have laid out for identifying the correct owner, indicating some basis for the reduction or the increase. And these matters go right to whether you have a valid proceeding or not. They're absolutely parallel with the requirements in a normal civil action that a plaintiff obtain proper service of process on his defendant.
What would be your
Yes, and I think the statutes have to be construed as a whole, Your Honor. Those two sections that he does cite, and if I may, hold on. Okay. The two sections speak to tax records, but property ownership as a legal matter is not determined in the tax records. It's determined by instruments of conveyance, and those are only lodged in the recorder's office. Well, in that case, Your Honor, there'd be no public record.
Right.
There'd be no public record at all.
Right.
And obviously, to ascertain such things, that'd be like some, if I may analogize, that would be the defendant who's been served at his address saying, well, I moved 2 weeks ago. I just haven't gotten around to changing my post office box yet. Well, at some point, the courts should allow reliance on public records. My argument below is that there is a heightened duty of inquiry, especially where the records themselves indicate there is a discrepancy between the value on the conveyance fee statement and the listing of the owner, Mr. Sansloni. That is part of my core procedural efficiency argument, as well as to answer the school board's fairness argument. The school districts have a generalized interest here to maximize revenue through the assessment process and valuation process. But the property owner, in answering a complaint from a school board, has a particularized property interest that is protected by the due process clause. And fairness, if you get into a balancing issue here at all on fairness, it has to come down on the side of the property owner. Just as in any civil matter, the plaintiff has the initial duties to properly initiate the action, obtain service of process on his defendant. Because the defendant, it's after all the status quo is going to be affecting the defendant's rights or the rights that are at stake, and that's what due process protects in such a case. we have the same case by analogy. It's the fairness and due process. If it's a balancing issue, you have to weigh on the property owner, in the property owner's favor in this case, for the same reason. It's his property rights, the value of his property and his tax burden that are being ultimately have the particularized effect. In summary, Your Honor, the case law since the 1970s is firmly on our side. The Supreme Court has never varied from the proposition that the complaint is jurisdictional in nature, conferring subject matter jurisdiction, and the Board of Revision simply has no jurisdiction. That was raised by my client through the counter-complaint process as soon as the proceeding was reopened, and I think we have to look at the that substantial justice was done, that the law was followed ultimately. Appellant's arguments that we had another remedy or an exclusive remedy simply don't hold water. If the cases are reviewed carefully, they all deal with mandamus actions and the effort to other efforts using mandamus to compel an auditor or a treasurer to correct illegal assessments that they've refused to do. We were in the valuation stage here. It's not an exclusive remedy. The remedy that ultimately was used, which was the reconsideration remedy, was adequate and did substantial justice. Thank you, Your Honor.
All right, just 2 points. This question about whether they could have sued under 272301. On page 3 of my brief, I quote the statute, and you'll see there that they can do two different things. It says courts may enjoin the illegal levy and entertain actions to recover them. So there's two. If they've paid the tax, they can sue to recover it. If it hasn't yet been collected, they can sue to have it enjoined. Obviously, if it's been collected already, they couldn't enjoin it. So that since it hadn't yet been collected, they could have gone ahead and done it. And secondly, 5715.19, which talks about the filing of countercomplaints, says they must be filed within 30 days of the March 31 deadline for the school board to file, which clearly didn't happen here. So again, the whole process under which they make their claims simply isn't provided for by statute. Thank you.
Thank you. Okay, so the remarks submitted and be advised as well.
Thank you.
All right. Hear ye, hear ye, hear ye. These hearings of the Supreme Court of Ohio Baptist Commission now stand adjourned.